Hello and welcome to Let's Pod This. Friends, welcome back to another exciting episode. We've been off for a few weeks because it's been summertime.
Good life.
It's been busy. But now, school is back in.
It is.
Emily is back with us here in studio. We've got a bit of a new setup that will evolve over time for any of you who are watching online. And honestly, we'll just take a big stab at this. Who knows what the sound quality will be like when we're done.
God, help us.
But also joining us today is our good friend, Dr. Pappas. Christine.
Yay.
Pappas, welcome back to the program.
Hey, it's nice to join you.
We're so excited to see you. I'm going to set this down so that Emily and I can hear you better. But thanks for being here. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
You're my favorite legal eagle.
I love it.
That. Don't tell PJ Kins that, but you're my... I mean, it's an obvious situation. I'm so glad to see you, number one. Like, you know, the political science-y parts of things are, we're so disparate, and you're in Ada, and I am in the metro area, and so, you know, we are ships crossing in the night.
That's right. We valiantly try to keep the community going with the Oklahoma Political Science Association, but it's not always easy.
Valiant is the word, my friend. I heard that you are, as well, driving the small bus, if you will, down to Weatherford. I am doing the same. How many students do you think you're bringing?
Well, I've got two panels I'm thinking of, so we might have up to 15 students.
Fabulous. So for our listeners, we're talking shop right now.
Yeah.
They know that you and I host, Andy and I host, CivicsCon in April, but Christine and I are on the executive board of the Oklahoma Political Science Association, and we host our conference, like all good masochists, on election week, right? The Thursday and Friday of election week is always when the state political scientists and our students and journalists and anybody who wants to come get together. And this year we are hosting it at SWASU down in Weatherford. Our homie, mm-hmm. Dr. David Searcy, is hosting it, who paneled for us.
Yes.
On Christian nationalism at CivicsCon earlier this year. So it's going to be a good time. Dr. Pappas brings her students and we do poster presentations. I bring foist upon my international relations students poster presentations. They got their jump start yesterday, and I've got kids signed up to hotel and do the things. So get excited. Go to the OPSA website. You can just Google Oklahoma Political Science Association and get tickets. We offer them pretty cheap. We're going to have a special awards dinner at the Stafford Air and Space Museum we're going to be down in Weatherford.
Yeah.
Apparently they're getting some cool paraphernalia that has apparently been on the moon, right? Some shuttle gear is literally landing, but
nice.
Between now and November, Bill Moore, who is the brother of my friend Rick Moore, who is in Oklahoma politics. He was an astronaut and has done many missions, and is going to come speak for us as well. So it's going to be a really cool conference.
That's
just
amazing.
Generally speaking. So if you're interested, get on the website or email us. And we'll give you more information. So.
Yeah.
But just shameless plugging.
We have no shame. No shame here.
No, I drove through Weatherford just the other day.
We went
to Santa Fe last week,
right,
and drove through. And I haven't ever been to the Stafford Air and Space Museum, but it's supposed to be fantastic. Mm-hmm. And because of him and his ties to NASA and to Oklahoma as a whole, like the Historical Society History Center, has access to like Smithsonian stuff, exhibits that other states don't have access to.
Yep.
And he has, I guess, out there, like, a lot of stuff that you can't see anywhere else, which is weird. If you've never been to Weatherford, there's not a whole lot going on out there. You're just like, oh, there's planes in the middle of the fields. But no, there's planes on the plains. But there's actual, like, air and space stuff. So I may have to...
Yeah.
I think I'm a lifetime member of the OPSA.
You, indeed, you are on the website, sir.
Right.
I would expect for you to be in Weatherford, at least for the dinner.
I'll see what I can do.
I'm sure you'll be on a panel that I've not thought of yet, but it's going to happen, I'm sure.
We'll see.
Yeah, indeed. So, hi, Christine.
Hey, what's going on?
Obviously, you are here to be a legal eagle because of your position, which you should remind our listeners of. But we know that you have, all of the smarts when it comes to everything going on with the SCOTUS. You and I have done an op-ed together, and you've flown off without me. Was that your first op-ed experience?
Yes, yeah, that was great. Thank you.
I love that. That op-ed made it to SCOTUS Blog.
Yeah, we got to do it again.
We really do. I'm teaching that class again at OCU in the spring, so we will definitely do it again. But I wanted to, or we wanted to get you on the podcast to give sort of a roundup of the latest SCOTUS docket that ended in June 30th, whatever. You know, time is a construct because they continue to issue things even after, you know, their session is actually over. This was an interesting one, right? So they, and I actually, you mentioned your Ruth Bader Ginsburg coolness on the back of your wall. I got to do a private tour of the Supreme Court and actually got to do that tour with the sitting clerk. So the dude who's been there for the last, since really the aughts started, was giving us sort of the behind the scenes, and I got to ask him a question about the docket, right? The shadow docket specifically. You would have been really proud of me. I asked, because I'm dying to know, you know, whether or not they're taking on less cases, right, committing to less cases on the actual docket because they're anticipating more, you know, emergency challenges, things like that, not just necessarily from the Trump administration, although we've seen quite an increase. And he was like, no, not really. We're just, it's just kind of attrition over time. It was a really interesting, it was not what I expected as a political scientist.
Yeah.
As a judicial scholar, would that be your take?
Well, yeah, let me back up. So the Supreme Court became a court of elective docket in 1925 because before then they had to take every single case that came along. And so it could be hundreds or thousands of cases. So then ever since 1925, they've taken 50 to 150 cases depending on who was the Chief Justice. And so it was assumed that if that case wasn't taken for cert, then the court wasn't going to decide it. But now they've created this other mechanism, the shadow docket or this rocket docket, where they're issuing opinions and not actually having to hear the case or letting the sides have a say in court. So it's a practice that seems to be expanding. But I think the more attention that's brought to it, the more likely it is either they'll go and explain why they're doing it on these certain cases. Because initially it was sort of like cases that didn't have to have a public hearing, or maybe there was a clear result that they wanted to find. But now we've seen it happening with some more politically divisive cases. So I think the more we see it used in cases where we think there should be a public hearing, the more likely the Supreme Court will dial it back, go back to letting each side have its say.
That's interesting. Yeah, it's just something that I've obviously, this is not my area. I'm IR, right? we dabble in this. And so I've just, over teaching and the last couple of years, those upper level con law and politics of law classes, I just have sort of noticed and wondered. Thank you for that.
Well, and while we're kind of talking the scholarship of the Supreme Court, let me mention a new study that just came out by Lee Epstein, who, she's my favorite political scientist who studies the Supreme Court, if one were to have such a person in their life. But she has written a lot on oral argument and judicial fluidity and judicial strategy that's used on the court. And so she and her writing partner, Eric Posner, just published an article called Two Decades of Oral Argument at the Supreme Court. So it looks at oral argument from 2005 to 2025. And it's fascinating. You might know that during COVID, the court stopped its traditional method of oral argument 30 minutes aside. And they kind of, when they went on Zoom, they had every justice speak for a few minutes. And so that caused justices generally to speak longer. So the oral arguments have gone from about 60 minutes to 90 minutes now. And for years, 15 years, Clarence Thomas didn't say a word at all at oral argument. But then during COVID era, he began speaking. They'd call on him and he'd be there with a question. So ever since that change, he's been asking more questions. So I want to just say, Justice Jackson is the most loquacious. She speaks approximately 1,200 words per case. And then Thomas is about 61 words per case. 61 per case, but that includes like 15 years of nothing. So Jackson speaks the very, very most, and it's hypothesized that's because she finds herself in the minority so often, she's trying to score points quickly in oral argument. And when they go into judicial conference to discuss how a case is going to come out, because she's the junior justice and she'll speak last, everyone will have voted by the time she opens her mouth. So she has to get her points made in a forum before they vote, which is the oral argument. So there's a little bit of debate about how much emphasis on the outcome of the opinion the oral argument actually has. Some people say it doesn't make any difference whatsoever. But there's been different times when people have come up with novel arguments the justices have never heard before, and it has created some judicial fluidity. So I'm very interested in oral argument and opinion writing. Those are my favorite things to study. I'm very nerdy. I'm sorry to have dug this into this podcast.
Us and both of our listeners are nerds with you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, comrades.
Well, and I think I've always felt that way, that the oral arguments probably don't sway a decision much unless they are unexpectedly novel and they come out of nowhere. But, they've received all of the written materials, they've undoubtedly prepared, they kind of know what the arguments are going to be. And so unless it's a bit of a surprise, then it's just a formality of, thank you, may it please the court, let's just go through this. And again, these are enormous cases that have been litigated to a large extent in, multiple lower levels. And so to have them arrive here and to give it, an hour, maybe an hour and a half, it's not like that hour and a half is going to be particularly compelling unless there's something unexpected there.
Right.
I don't know, man. I love... So, kind of like you, Christine, I have gotten into listening to the oral arguments, and especially the last... I mean, this constituted court right now is spicy AF, dude. So, some of those oral arguments, man, like, my kids and I will listen as a class, and they get really chippy, man. I don't know. I love it. It's a good time. Politics, I'd always say, if you are really paying attention, it's better than reality television. I mean, it is reality television. Reality,
right?
And I'll also say that I teach constitutional law and civil rights and liberties and such, and we always do a Supreme Court simulation. And one of the cases that we actually did was the Learning Resources versus Trump case, which is the tariff case. And so my students, argued that case with each other and wrote opinions, and then we listened to the oral argument together. So it's an incredible learning tool to listen to this oral argument.
Especially the Solicitor General, they can learn a lot about what not to do from this guy, man. He's...
Mm-hmm. Are you talking about with Sauer? Is that him? Yeah.
He's rough, dude. He's rough. So tell us. So you pivoted. So what did you make of this last docket, and what were your kind of standout cases? Obviously, Calais. I'm sure we'll get into. But what were some of the other kind of highlights, or do you want to parse them into topics? Or because we had a lot on elections.
I would say generally the broad strokes is. The broad strokes are that civil rights and liberties are being dialed back and presidential power is growing. So those are the two things I would say. I think in the last 30 years, we've seen sort of a rise and fall of a certain way of approaching civil liberties, where we saw a rise of privacy jurisdiction or privacy jurisprudence, for example. So you have cases where, yes, there's a right to privacy, and it kind of grows and it shrinks. And so we're seeing that, with also, due process. It rises and then it shrinks. So you could also put the Calais decision in that, where voting rights jurisprudence rises and shrinks. And so I really think we've seen sort of a rise and fall of the Warren Court's jurisprudence, because for a while it was expanding through the 60s and 70s, and then 80s and 90s it was kind of cut back, and then now we've seen the death knell for some of these doctrines. So, of course, the abortion case is a prime example there, Tasebo versus Wade overturned. And so I think that's what we're seeing with this very conservative court. And it's been shown it's one of the most conservative in the history of the United States. So it's not invective to call it conservative. It just is very much more conservative than courts that we've seen in the past.
Yeah.
Which is saying something, because we've had some pretty conservative courts in the past.
Yeah. Yeah.
And just so our listeners are on the same page, of the 9 justices, is it 5 that Trump has appointed?
Yeah, I think that's... Let me get a picture real quick. And
I mean, I feel like... Because I think it's the same at the state level here, that Governor Stitt has appointed 5, and it's unusual to have one president appoint more than half the court, just based on how long people live, normally, and no term limits on the court.
Right.
So Sotomayor, Brown, Thomas...
This is great podcasting. Let's just have a total dead air.
5 were before, or Biden appointing.
Right. So.
Them. It's okay. Comey Barrett. It's it's Kavanaugh.
Yeah.
And Gorsuch.
So just 3.
3, Coney Barrett, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh. But then you've also got Thomas, who is George Herbert Walker Bush. You've got John Roberts, who is George W. Bush, Alito, George W. Bush, and then Kagan was Obama. Yeah, and also Sotomayor. And just while we're talking about the personnel, I noticed so many times, you know, the liberal wing is 3. And it's 3 women, and I kind of wonder, what is the effect of having only women on that liberal wing? I wonder how persuasive they can be with their brethren.
Which is a sad reality. Although statistically, I mean, looking at the electorate and the partisan divide among genders, it's pretty substantial. Yeah. It's like 60, well, maybe it's not substantial, well, it's all about margins, but there was some report the other day about where people fall politically and or for partisanship, and I want to say it was like 60% of women or 65% of women identify as Democrat,
and then for
men, it's like the opposite.
Sure.
5% identify as conservative.
Yeah.
Point though, Christine, I do wonder, maybe not on the brethren, but certainly on Comey Barrett, I think that, you know, they may have, and the way that the court splits, and the, you know, the dissents have been really interesting with this court as well. It's not always been the breaks, you know, these have not always been the 3 that you think.
Yeah.
A lot, or had a lot of opinions with Alito, for example, or with Roberts recently. It's been really interesting.
Yeah. And I'd say that the wild cards on the right are Gorsuch and Coney Barrett. Those are the ones you see as less predictable.
Unexpected and a little relieving, I think, to a lot of people.
Sure.
Yeah. But you've got Thomas on the right, you've got Alito on the right, and those guys are so anchored. They're not budging at all. But then Roberts sometimes wants to jump over to the majority to get out of the minority if he feels like it's going the wrong way. So leading from the back a little bit.
Yeah, I feel like he is, I think in his early career, he was certainly more concerned with legitimacy. I feel like that has waned a little bit recently. And I don't know if that's just the political climate or him just trying to muddle through.
Right. In his confirmation hearings, he famously said that the justices should just call the balls and strikes and not inject their personal opinion, but it's really shown that he's not as impartial as he thinks he is. The facade has come off.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. I think that he had a real opportunity to, insert ethics and codes of conduct in a more formalized manner, and I think that his legacy is going to be the shenanigans of Clarence, regardless of how much he wants that to be his legacy.
Sure.
I think he's going to own some of that.
Yeah.
So at the Supreme Court level, there's nobody who can tell a justice to recuse himself or herself. So sometimes they do, especially if they argued the case as Solicitor General, or they saw it in the lower circuit court judge. But we have a number of cases where Clarence Thomas actually had very tight financial dealings with people before the court, and he just will not recuse himself. So if Roberts won't have official rules, then we have to assume he's taking care of things behind the scenes, but if he's not doing that either, then, I mean, that's another way that he's really lost legitimacy.
Yeah.
I just can't imagine rising to that level of your career and being like, well...
Right.
that's to Emily's point, like, when we talk, you know, in 20 years from now, when we talk about the Roberts Court and what was defining of it, it may very well not be Roberts.
Yeah.
Which is, I don't know. I just can't imagine.
Well, what's one legal doctrine that Roberts came up with? There's literally nothing. He sort of camped out in the middle, and you have Clarence Thomas championing some ideas that really seem crazy, and then become law of the land. You have Scalia, you have Alito, but they just sort of drag Roberts along with them. But what does he stand for? Nothing.
Really interesting. So, of the cases that made cert in the last docket, 2526, does anything stand out? You mentioned the expansion of executive power, but is the court looking for specific concepts to affirm, disaffirm, to expand power, to limit power? Are there any trends that you're seeing in terms of the Roberts Court and the more recently constituted, version.
Right. So generally, Roberts Court seems to be pro-executive power. We see that in a lot of ways. However, there are two important cases I want to point out. And the very most important case that I was watching in the last term is the birthright citizenship case. To me, I felt like disallowing people born in this country to be citizens strikes at the very heart of what it means to be American. Because we are not a country that's created by a race. We're created by our values. And that is shutting the door on people to the traditional way that you become American. So when the Supreme Court struck down President Trump's executive order in Trump versus Barbara, I think that was very strong. I think the executive order was so far beyond the pale, like so far out there, it shouldn't even have been part of our discourse. But at least the Supreme Court stepped up and struck that down. And the other case I think is important where they limited Trump's power is the Learning Resources versus Trump. That's the tariff case where they voted 6-3 that Trump exceeded his power under the International Emergency Executive Powers Act to impose his pretty baseless tariffs. And when the tariffs were imposed, like, no one thought they were legitimate. But again, it was amazing that the Supreme Court actually did stand up to Trump and say, that's exceeding your power. So those two are cases where Trump's power is dialed back. Two that surprised me about removal power, it's a pretty strong bedrock that the president can appoint and remove executive branch officers, and the creation of a merit-based executive branch and protecting people from political vindictiveness. Like, it's very important that when you put the person in on a commission or the Federal Reserve Board, they're able to serve out their term. That's that's what something that's created the competence of our government. But in two cases, the Supreme Court allowed Trump to remove people off the Federal Trade Commission and also from the Federal Reserve Board, and not for cause, just because political reasons he could remove those two people. So that overturned centuries of precedent regarding the power to appoint. So,
yeah, the learning resource case, I think, is one that I wasn't sure that they were going to really involve themselves in heavily, based on, you know, the idea that the executive has more power unilaterally in foreign policy decisions, right? And so I think it is interesting that they noted the punitive nature of his tariff policies. And I do wonder, what we're talking today, as, you know, in 2 days, what is today? Mm-hmm. 2 days on the 19th, I don't know what today is. Time is a construct. Maybe tomorrow. The new 50% increase tariffs are supposed to go into effect on Canada, right? So he's upped yet another, tariff on an ally. And so I wonder, given the way that the learning resources case was decided, whether or not those tariffs are going to be allowed to go into effect, and if they're not going to be challenged. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, and this is a question, I think, for both of you. I think, you know, Christine, you said early on in the episode that one of the trends for this year in the court has been the expansion of executive power.
Yeah.
And I think historically we often saw that power given to somebody, like with a affirmative legislative measure or something. And in this case, what we've seen with President Trump, I think, is that he has just acted however he wants to act, and it's like a ask forgiveness rather than permission model. And the court then, I mean, they have supported that. Is it because there's obviously political pressure, but like sometimes, this debate about whether or not it was a textualist or a originalist perspective on this, which seems weird in this case, because originally, the whole point of setting up this country was to rein in executive power from the king.
Yeah.
And so having an originalist perspective doesn't seem to jive with what we're actually seeing.
Yeah, but I think what you're talking about also fits in with the political question doctrine, because the Supreme Court doesn't like to weigh into political questions and be the body that's going to come in and hand a party their win. So I think that there's a way that they kind of soft pedal these issues if they're really too political. So maybe the law's really clear, but they feel like they can't wade into it. So to the idea that Chief Justice Roberts wants to be seen as legitimate and impartial, he needs to stay out of political questions. But he seems to say, I won't get involved in a political question, but then he always decides them in a certain direction. So it kind of makes you wonder about that. Because tariffs are more seen as international policy, obviously the executive has more power to be able to make a foreign policy. And another area that fits with that also is the immigration policy. So we've seen Trump, for example, in temporary protected status for Syrians and Haitians, and that was upheld by the Supreme Court that he could do that. And I guess listeners should also remember, like President Obama, when he wanted to do DACA through an executive order, the court also said that that could be done through an executive order. So the sword is going to swing both ways on this. So if a Republican president can do it, a Democratic president can do it as well. And a question on the same kind of idea is, will future presidents take this authority that's been given to Trump? Because everyone's saying, oh, this is illegitimate, it shouldn't be done this way. But when they are president, will they try to exceed and fill these same powers in the same way? And I imagine that we will continue to see an expansion of the executive just because that's what executives are going to do. absolutely, you know, power just like grows, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And when you give people an inch, they take a mile, and that will continue to happen, I imagine.
Yeah, I warn my students constantly about setting precedent, right? You're allowing this president to set a precedent. So that means that your worst nightmare or, you know, whatever, whoever comes next is going to at least be able to live up to that standard or live by those standards, if not exceed or expand them. That's a dangerous thing.
And that argument doesn't really seem to persuade many Republicans, like partisans on the Hill, except when it comes to the filibuster. That seems to be the one place where they say, okay, we literally cannot destroy the filibuster. That is the only thing. But every other thing, it doesn't seem like they are scared that Democrats will seek to exceed power in the way that Trump is seeking it in his term.
Yeah.
Well, and I've had that argument with some of my friends. In fact, I think in the early days of this podcast, my then co-host Scott Nelson and I argue about this frequently, where he historically would like to nuke the filibuster and do away with it. And I have said, buddy, there's going to come a time when we're going to need it.
Yeah.
And that's happened this year, right? Like there's been times where the Republicans are like, well, we can't get over it. Even with the president breathing on their neck. And so it's one of those things that what's good for the goose is good for the gander sometimes. But it is a slippery slope. And I think one other thought, and then I'll shut up, but at the state level, with the state Supreme Court, where that's where five justices have been appointed by the governor in the last 8 years, which is wild. He, you know, when Stitt first came into office, he asked the legislature, I need more authority to hire and fire agency heads. And they said, okay.
And
they gave it to him a few times.
That.
And then within about a year, you could kind of sense they were like, maybe, okay, let's not do that anymore.
Yeah.
And then now, as his term is ending, like even this last session, they were starting to talk of like, well, maybe we should we rein that power back in? Because like, what if a Democrat wins? And so you get that like, that partisan, we'll say even-handedness. Well, no, it's not even-handed, but like, the partisan influence there where they recognize that any person in power is likely to wield that power now that it's been welled, right? And I don't know, this makes me think of the Lord of the Rings and like the power of the ring, all this stuff, like finding a good person is hopefully, right? I think American voters are starting to understand that we do need to care about the moral fabric of the individual inhabiting that office for a period of time. Because if someone is of weak moral character, right? Like this is a really nerdy podcast now besides the Supreme Court, but this is why Frodo had the ring, right? Because as a hobbit, they are morally stronger than men who are known to be weak, and that the weak would succumb to the power and use it to destroy the whole world. And they needed this good little being to finish the task.
Common good.
Common good.
Right?
Yeah. Okay. Well,
I love you.
Come for the Supreme Court, stay for the Shire.
Were you at all surprised by the birthright citizenship case and the way that it was decided?
I was holding out hope that the court would do the right thing, in my view, and I believe that they did. So I would have been shocked. I guess nothing seems to surprise me anymore with the court or the presidency or the country or the state. Like, everything that comes down the pike seems unprecedented. So I was extremely, extremely relieved about Trump versus Barbara, the birthright citizenship case. But I wouldn't have been surprised the other way if they'd found the executive order was constitutional.
You mentioned earlier the fabric and the identity of the United States and it being challenged with that case. In international relations, and I'm sure you know this as well, we talk about citizenship from two different views, right? Just sanguine citizenship by blood and by soil, right? Just soil. It obviously we do this by the latter, right? It's about where we are born, and we are constituting this nation based on this the values, the concepts, the identity is based on, you know, liberty and freedom and equality and all of these things that, you know, make America what it is, as opposed to this, you know, bloodline, right? And it's an important thing, I think, for Americans living today to really recognize that we're unique in that way. Yeah. And that is something that I feel like, you know, the continuity of this democracy really rests upon more of us and the younger generation realizing that birthright citizenship is a really incredibly important thing. How do we, and this is what I ask my upper level law kids, or political science kids going to law school, you know, how do you go about defining citizenship? How do you go about defining my citizenship after this, right? Because I don't know, I don't do the DNA.com stuff because, you know, I have like issues with spitting in a jar and sending it to somebody to keep in a repository for me for the rest of, you know, eternity. But I assume, you know, at some point there were folks who, in my bloodline, who were not, who didn't originate here, right? And I feel like that's the case for a lot of us, black, white, wherever we are, right? Whatever we come from. And I feel like, you know, how far back are we going to go? And I know that there were stipulations written into, you know, the case about, you know, looking at a person's ethnicity, but I really feel like, or their ancestry, but I really feel like splitting hairs and deciding these things in a hospital room and, you know, whether or not you get ordained an American citizen or not, if I, by percentage of blood or, you know, whatever that is, it feels so, it feels wrong to my soul. And so I don't know.
I'm American.
Like, yeah, right. I don't know. I needed to go on the soapbox. I'm sorry. I told you I felt ranty today. But it was, I don't know. It still feels really raw, and my therapist, of all people, I'm usually the one that he's like, he's petting me, right? That's the whole deal. I walked into his office that day the case was decided, and I was like, hey, aren't you excited? He was like, yeah, I'm like, no, not really, fuck this room. Like, bro, we're citizens. Like, he's also not not a Joe Smith type of person. So it was really kind of shocking for me to be the jovial one that day on birthright citizenship.
That's funny. I mean, and I agree with you. I think.
What a cheer.
I know. I'm so glad you brought this up, Emily, because I have been thinking about this week too. But I was listening to the GD Politics podcast, mm-hmm. which I listen to every week. That episode on about, specifically about Latino voters, that's really worth listening to. If you subscribe, you should go listen to it. But they were talking about just immigration in general and then what it means to be an American.
Yeah.
And I do think that we as Americans take this for granted because we grew up here. We don't think about this.
Mm-hmm.
But America is unique in this way that many other countries,
like
if you're Norwegian, it's because you're Norwegian, like by and large, right? Are there some immigrants? Yes,
sure.
Some,
right?
But not like America.
Yeah.
Even, you know, England, France, like other like Western democracies that we think of having, you know, migrants and all this stuff. Yes, but it's still very different.
Yeah.
Like to be French is different than to be American.
Hell yes, it is.
And to be Russian, to be Ugandan.
Yeah.
You know, I think Australia in some ways gets closer because of how that land was like colonialized.
Yeah.
But
I could make it, and we could argue about it.
Right. I still think it's almost more British than it is American.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
For sure, right?
Yeah.
And so this idea that like we take for granted that which we have never contemplated.
Yeah.
Because we've just accepted it.
It just is.
That's like how you lose things, right? Like
exactly.
And so just like the Gettysburg Address kind of restates our belief in the Declaration of Independence, and just like maybe the Civil Rights Act restates our belief in equality, maybe from this political debate we will be able to rededicate ourselves to these values. That's what I'm really hopeful for, because people have never thought about it. What does it mean to be American by where you're born and to inculcate yourself with these values? And if we say we believe in liberty and equality, and then our government is not providing policies that create such values and really bring the fruit forward from them, then I think people are going to start demanding different policies from our government. And especially the way we're, it just seems like, oh, you committed a crime? We're going to put you in the Oklahoma County Jail where you might just die. And, oh, well, you overstayed your visa? We're going to put you in a detention center where you just might die. Like, when did these people stop being people? When did that be okay for our government using money that we provided through our labor and our taxes? Why did it come to the government treating people so unequally? So I'm really hoping that we have a renewed commitment to liberty and equality.
So I want to reinforce what you just said, because it's in the 14th Amendment. It's in the thing that the birthright right is. Right, it's right. Justice and a day in court for all people, not just citizens. That is such an important part of the 14th Amendment because it makes sure to distinguish between citizens and people, mm-hmm. right? Oh my God, thank you, Christine. I just needed to reaffirm my rantiness. But yeah, man, that is such an important, so important, so important.
Well, and yes.
Sorry.
It is. And I keep using in my head, I think of the word negligence mm-hmm. And like just neglect. Yeah. That there is a darkness growing, right? And this is like negligence of our neighbor, right? That many Americans seem to be willfully neglectful of.
I don't know that it's negligence. I'd go with malice.
Well, in
lots of cases, it's not just that I don't see you, I don't care about you, it's that I see you and I don't give a fuck.
Right, right. No, I think you're right.
Sorry about it.
Well, I probably see it as like a bit of a continuum from like care to malice, and that there have always been these bad actors.
Yeah.
Suddenly, these bad actors are in charge of shit.
Yeah, and, there you go. Okay.
And because they have normalized malice, mm-hmm. it makes the negligence in between, like, less bad,
yeah,
but,
it feels
more,
like,
but
yeah,
more okay.
Like, and so people are like, you're ignoring me, I'm good. Yeah.
Well, and because a lot of people are like, I'm so concerned about the malice, I don't have the capacity to care for those in the middle. And so I'm sure it parallels with the wealth inequality gap, right? That like the people at the top of this are just more distant from the rest of us down here. And it blows me away when you see the stats about like the sheer number of people who are in the normal range. Like, there was some report the other day of, like, the middle class is gone because we're all lower class now. There's, like, us and them, and there's, like, a chasm in between. And we end up fighting amongst ourselves about, you know, over cookie crumbs. And in fighting over cookie crumbs, we are often neglecting to feed our neighbor or ensure that they have housing or whatever. And it is, I'm not trying to blame the common man for this struggle, but I think when we look at the 30,000 foot anthropological societal level shift that's happened over the last 10 years, this chasm between those that have and are in power and those that don't and are the rest of us here, I just feel like 250 years ago we would have had a revolution.
Well, let me say, I feel like my education harped on the Gilded Age, and these industrials were so rich, and it was so terrible, and we've learned that we don't do it that way, and now we all pay our taxes, so we can have a middle class, and we can have roads, and sanitation, and things that we all care about, and now we've just kind of gotten away from that, like, it got taken for granted too long, and now we're back to the point where we are seeing extreme disarticulation of wealth, I mean, way more than ever before. And then I had a second awesome point that I have now completely forgot, so I'm going to wait for a minute quietly.
But your point on the Gilded Age is well taken. I think that you know, history, if it doesn't repeat itself, it at least rhymes, right? That, like, mm-hmm. we have been here before, and, you know, there's lots of people who have, like, said, you know, every 40 years or every 80 years, we seem to commit the same kind of things. And it's like, well, yeah, that's like, you know, three generations removed, and now we've since forgotten it. I remember having a conversation with Bailey Perkins Wright when she was on our podcast, where her grandfather or great-grandfather was a slave, mm. And my grandfather was a sharecropper, and we like talked about, you know, just a couple of generations removed.
Sure.
We talk about this stuff like it's a distant history, and it wasn't. Mm-mm. But just one more generation, it really does feel like it's distant, right? Like the distance from me to my grandfather, I knew him well. I knew my great-grandparents a little bit. But like beyond that is ancient history as far as I'm concerned. And so I think about my kids now and how they view the world, that they've lost whatever frame of reference that I had in my youth, and or sadly having to relearn some of these like moral lessons.
Yeah. I thought on my second point, the person that my students want to meet more than anyone is Zoran Mamdani. And they are on fire from learning about socialism. So this is maybe the backlash from the wealth distribution.
And, I mean, I too would love to meet Mayor Mamdani, to be honest.
That's great.
Because, not because he's a democratic socialist, but because he's like delivering real results to people that are helping people.
Exactly.
And they got discounted World Cup tickets to boot. Like it's like, oh, you want to shovel snow? You want free pre-K?
Yeah.
You want expanded buses? You want cheaper groceries? Like, these are things that everybody can relate to. It's not like, do you want a gilded ballroom? No. Like I would be okay with a gilded ballroom if people have food. Like, there's lots of those things. But then, on top of that, he's like, also, you know, New Yorkers were able to buy tickets to the World Cup for $50.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, well, now it feels like... It's like I think of it the same way that I said earlier about Trump coming in and being like, I'm just going to do it. You can tell me I can't. And Mamdani's kind of done that. And that there's a lot of memes of him like, well, he's so good at like just doing things. It seems like the other guys were kind of fabricating how hard it was. And it's like, maybe that's true.
Right.
But when you use your power for good.
Right. And you don't care how much it costs
Well, that's the flip side. Right.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Although, to be fair, I don't think the president cares how much things
cost. Well, yeah.
Well... But look at the big capitalist calling Walmart and telling them to lower their prices. I mean, how is that not a socialist price floor, everyone?
I am so in love with this, and we have to end pretty soon. I'm going to give you the final word here in a second, but I do love the fact that we're screaming about socialism, really we're screaming about communism, and we don't know the difference between communism and socialism, but we're doing so after we've bought shares of, or bought percentages of IBM and these other massive companies, right? That is literal socialism.
Right.
Like, that is Trump-branded socialism. I don't care what you call it. Whenever the government is investing, literally, buying shares, right, percentages of a company, of a private company.
Right.
Hi.
They are owning,
hello.
Owning the production.
I'm just saying. Christine, final words, because I'm already late for a Zoom call.
Oh. I'm so sorry.
No, it's not you. It's me. It's us. This is great.
As the Trump administration continues toward its last years of its existence, I think we're going to probably see increased erratic behavior from the president. And I think it's important that each act be challenged, and all of the usual players, ACLU, the different corporations that have to sue him, the individuals, they're going to become so fatigued trying to keep up with all of the things that are needing to be challenged. It's going to be very difficult, but I think we're going to see increasing erratic policies from the Trump administration and an increased need to keep challenging these. And then that'll put the Supreme Court right in the crosshairs. And in Theodore Lilly's book, The End of Liberalism, it wasn't about the end of liberal policies. It was the end of like being able to make policies through our political branches. We're putting all of these things into the hands of the court. And so we're not using democracy. We're using these unelected judges to make policy for us. But we're making them do it because we're not allowing the political branches to work. So it's going to be a weird couple years in the future as we see the what goes on toward the end of the Trump administration.
Yeah.
That was fantastic.
That's a great final word.
Excellent.
I mean, terrifying, but also probably accurate.
Let me just say scheduled end of the Trump administration.
There we go. Appreciate that. Not at all ominous.
At all. Yeah, no. Thank you so much for being here and sharing your wisdom, Christine. You are by far my favorite legal eagle.
Thank you. Hugs from far.
So great. Thank you, yes. Christine, for being here. Emily, thanks for being here as well. Listeners, thank you for joining us as well. Don't forget, next Tuesday, August 25th, is an election day. Super important. If you're a Democrat, if you're a Republican, if you're an independent, if you're a libertarian, there is something on the ballot for you.
Yes.
There are two state questions. I will tell you, as an organization, we've taken an oppositional approach to both. One is for voter ID, which we already have, and we don't need a constitutional amendment. And the other one gives too much power to the legislature to fiddle with how they reimburse cities and counties and school districts. And you can read more on our website, letsfixthis.org/vote. There's a whole voter hub with lots of other resources and links to voter guides and all that details. And then please tell your friends.
Indeed.
Turnout is going to make the difference on the state questions and on the candidate races. Turnout, we expect to be 10, maybe 12%. And that's just a few hundred thousand people. So every vote really matters. As we say every week, decisions are made by those who show up Tuesday the 25th.
Indeed.
Thanks a lot.